ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's always a question sort of lurking around in my mind, which is, you know, I'm a little neurotic. I'm a little crazy. I'm a little weird. And is that because I was studied? And who would I have been if I hadn't been studied?
In research, there's something called the observer effect, and it's when the very act of watching something changes or influences the thing being watched. For Susanna Breslin, you could say her entire life is the observer effect in action, because for 30 years, she was watched by psychology researchers.
Jack and Jean Block, in the late 1960s, conceived Block and Block longitudinal study. And at the time, there was this paradigm crisis in personality research. People just weren't clear on whether or not personality traits were real and whether they remained stable over the course of a lifetime. And the only way to find out was to gather together a group of kids and study them from childhood and well into adulthood, and then see, you know, could you see they were essentially the same person over time?
Susanna was one of 128 kids that the Blocks recruited for this study. And while the researchers definitely didn't intend to play a role in shaping their participants, Susanna says in her case, they absolutely did, in ways both positive and negative.
Ultimately, I had a longer relationship with the study than I did with my father. So it was kind of like a third parent.
This is All in the Mind. I'm Sana Qadar. Usually on the show, we talk to researchers, right? We talk about their studies, we talk about what they find. We rarely hear from research subjects. So today, we explore the confusing and unusual experience of being part of a decades-long psychological study.
My name is Susanna Breslin. I'm an investigative journalist and the author of Data Baby, My Life in a Psychological Experiment. You know, there's all these ways in which researchers try and limit how much they affect the thing that they are studying. But I think I'm sort of a testament to the fact that that's more difficult to do than the scientists would like to believe. My parents were academics. They were intellectuals. They were cool in temperament. They were not touchy-feely. And they, I think, had high expectations for their children, that they wanted them to be exceptional in some way.
Susanna's story really starts with her parents, who put her forward for the Block study when she was just a baby.
My dad taught poetry at the University of California, Berkeley. The university ran a preschool that was a laboratory preschool. It was very exclusive. It had a years-long waiting list. And my parents thought it would be cool to have me enrolled in this nursery school. Kids were studied by researchers at the university. So it was a way to sort of, you know, get your kid involved in something important when they were 3 years old.
And so they thought being part of this study would make you exceptional?
Yeah, I think my parents thought that it would somehow set me on a path of exceptionalism.
Susanna's earliest memories of being part of the Block study are of this preschool. But at the time, she didn't know she was part of a study, and that was by design.
The preschool itself was essentially designed for spying on children. So it has two classrooms that are conjoined by an observation gallery where the researchers would sort of hide and study our behavior and listen to what we were saying to each other. And then periodically, I remember we would be pulled out of class and taken over to another building, which they called the game room. And I would play games with an adult. It just seemed like fun to me. But later I learned that I was actually being tested and studied.
What kind of games do you remember?
I mean, it's like really basic stuff. I remember there was a puzzle, I think, that had farm animals. And then if I was able to put it together correctly, I think I was given a little gift of some sort.
And what do you know that, like, now that they were trying to test with those kinds of things?
They were assessments designed to test all sorts of aspects of our personality. So one test was to evaluate our ability to delay gratification. We were brought in.
Susanna doesn't really remember how she performed on these early tests, because it wasn't until years later, when she was 7, that she had her first inkling that she was being observed. And by this point, preschool was obviously over, and all the kids in the study were now at separate schools. But the plan was to bring them back to the university for assessment at key developmental stages, which were the ages of 5, 7, 11, 14, 18, 23, and 32. And at each stage, the researchers would capture all kinds of data, like how the kids performed on IQ tests, on personality tests, and other tests. They would ask the kids about their lives. They would assess their report cards. And so it was during one of these assessments that Susanna realized she was being watched.
And my first memory of being studied was in an experiment room on the university's campus. I'd been brought there by one of the researchers, I believe, after school. It was late in the afternoon, and there was a bowl of M&Ms between us. And the examiner was asking me all these questions about myself. And then at one point he said, "Would you like some candy?" I think I sort of sensed that this was some kind of a test.
Right.
I was kind of precocious. I think I didn't want him to think I was just some little kid. Mm-hmm. And so I said, no, I didn't want any candy. Not long after, he said, I have to go take care of something. Will you wait here? And as soon as he walked out of the room, I was starving. So I jumped across the table, lunging for the candy, and I accidentally knocked over the bowl in the process. All these M&Ms went bouncing everywhere. I started grabbing the candy and shoving it in my mouth, hoping I wasn't going to get in trouble for making a mess. And then for some reason, I remember this very distinctly. I looked into this mirror that was on the wall, and I could see feel my cheeks turning pink. And I sensed that there was somebody on the other side of the mirror watching me. And in fact, that was a one-way mirror, and somebody was on the other side spying on me.
My gosh, that feels like a really kind of creepy experience and realization. How did you feel about knowing that you were being tested and then knowing that someone's watching?
I think I was sort of two minds of being watched or studied like that. On the one hand, I liked it. My parents were distant. They were busy. They were preoccupied with their careers. My father was writing books, and their marriage was falling apart. When I was in an experiment room at the university, it was exactly what I wanted. I was the center of attention. Mm. And they were interested in nothing but me. It was like a sort of dream for a kid. At the same time, I think I felt a lot of pressure to perform at some high level, that I was supposed to prove to them that I was exceptional. And if I didn't, maybe I wouldn't be able to come back again.
So, okay, as a kid, you sort of liked feeling like you were the center of attention, but you also felt a lot of pressure. Did your feelings about the study change as a teenager? Because, that's a time when we're rebelling. Did you still enjoy being a part of it, or did you ever feel like, I want out?
Once I was in my teenage years, my parents had gotten divorced, and I started acting out. I started experimenting with drugs. I started, getting myself into situations with much older boys than I should have been in. And I ran away from home. And my relationship to the study at that point was different. I was a little bit more suspicious because they were adults, and I think I felt at that point like I couldn't trust adults.
But Susanna says the researchers also served as confidants. She told them more secrets than she definitely told her parents.
The researchers were interested in the things that I was going through. They were interested in whether or not we were using drugs. They were interested in how our parents' divorces were affecting us. And I told them things I didn't tell anyone else. And I think at that point and moving forward, I sort of had this idea that this study potentially knew me better than I knew myself.
This was profound for Susanna, because the idea that she was important and that she mattered and someone cared were not messages she was getting at home. And so if you want to know the positive aspects of having been observed like this for Susanna, this is definitely one of them.
I have struggled with anxiety and depression my whole life. And I do wonder if I hadn't been studied and I hadn't had that third thing in my life, that the outcome for me might have been much bleaker, that I might have killed myself or gotten involved in something dangerous that I couldn't get myself out of. So I think while it was certainly complicated to be studied, I think ultimately it rescued me from a worse fate.
It would take a long time for Susanna to really start probing the more complicated aspects of how the study affected her, basically until her 40s. But in the meantime, the blogs were publishing papers on what they were finding as they were collecting the data on Susanna and the 100-odd other subjects.
So one thing they found out was when we were teenagers, some of us became depressed, especially among the girls. Girls who had at one point when they were younger been smart and confident when they hit adolescence became incredibly depressed. And they were able to look back and see that those smart, confident girls had realized in adolescence that we sort of didn't fit the mold of what at the time you were supposed to be as a girl. We weren't obedient. We didn't do as we were told. We weren't trying to sort of make other people happy. And that was what sort of spiraled us into depressions. They were also interested in how divorce was impacting us. And one thing that was interesting is they could almost predict our parents' divorces before they happened because they could look at our behavior and see when we were starting to act out and then triangulate that later with our parents' divorces. And they also discovered that it's not so much your parents getting divorced that can have a negative impact on you, but it's sort of how the parents handle the divorce that really is what affects you.
Mm. And those findings, like, they sound like really interesting, important findings. Do you know if they still hold today?
I believe they do. Another interesting one was they talked to us in adolescence about, you know, whether or not we were experimenting with drugs. And they discovered that the best adjusted among us were not the teens who were abstaining from drugs or the teens who were at that point abusing drugs heavily. It was the teens who experimented with drugs that ultimately were the best adjusted, which really flew in the face of, at the time, Nancy Reagan's anti-drug campaign.
Right.
What was it? Just don't do it.
Just say no.
Just say no. Okay. So according to the study, you shouldn't just say no to drugs or the teen. You should say, sure, just a little.
Just a little. Interesting. Okay. The smartest ones knew how to experiment safely. Susanna's final contact with the researchers, her final assessment, was in 1999 at the age of 32. By that point, she was working as a reporter in LA, covering, of all things, the porn industry, which is its own whole separate story, but you'll just have to read the book for that one.
They didn't have the funding for the first time to bring us back to Berkeley and assess us in person. And so they sent out these very lengthy surveys that we filled out, and it was a lot of sort of the same questions they've been asking us for decades.
Questions like how happy the participants considered themselves to be, and if they had romantic partners, how much money they made.
And I very dutifully filled mine out and sent it off. You know, it was like this thread that ran through my life, and I think ultimately I was sad that the study was coming to an end, but I also felt like I had been part of something important.
For the next decade, Susanna didn't really think much about the study again. All her life's ups and downs proceeded unobserved, and there were a lot of them. She moved cities, left journalism for a bit after burnout. She survived Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. Then she got PTSD from Katrina. She also became estranged from her family, got married in a shotgun wedding to a man who would later turn abusive, and then she got cancer.
This rare, aggressive type of breast cancer. And so an oncologist came in and said, hey, can I bring in, you know, my interns? And they all sort of gathered around me as I was in a room having a cocktail of chemo dumped into me.
Hmm.
and sort of taking notes and looking at me. And I thought, God, this is like being a human lab rat again. And that really set me on a journey of thinking about, like, who am I? Is this the person I'm supposed to be? Did the blocks foresee this person I was going to become? What did they predict for me? And that set me out on this journey to sort of understand how the study had shaped my life.
The result of all of that has been her memoir. And since the book has come out, she's been hearing from other people who've been in similar situations.
I think as I wrote my story about being a research subject, I sort of felt like I was insane. Like, I felt like this study had had this huge impact on me, but did it? Or was I just imagining things? So it's been very affirming to talk to other people who had similar experiences, like, oh my gosh, yeah, this was hugely impactful, but was a double-edged sword, that it was also sort of confusing and maybe just too much. I think one parallel is, you know, these kids whose parents are like mommy influencers.
Oh gosh, yeah.
Their lives are being sort of rolled out online on TikTok or Instagram. And I think it'll be interesting to hear from those kids. I think they're going to say similar things where, you know, they were sort of aware that they were sort of special in some way. You know, mommy says I got 1 million followers or whatever it is. But then also, you know, I think a lot of the relationships like these, they are very transactional. In those experiment rooms that I was in, you know, that's a transactional relationship. The experimenter is there for the data and you're there for the attention. And that is fundamentally dysfunctional. There's also an extreme, the power dynamic is also problematic.
Yeah.
The researcher has all the power and the subject has none. And I think being a young person in those types of relationships sets a foundation for life that creates problems down the line.
Yeah, it's so interesting you talk about the mommy bloggers and the kids who feature in those as an example, because towards the end of the book, you talk about how, at least in your case, you know, that very unequal relationship was in the service of research, whereas the way we share our lives on social media is in the service of, like, tech company profits.
Right. My principal investigators were benevolent. They wanted to enlighten humanity. They were sort of working in service of the greater good. That's why they were collecting our data. That's why they were studying us. And the cost was we didn't have a sort of private life of our own. Today, the people who are spying on us are, you know, tech company founders and CEOs. They're multi-billionaires. And their intention is singular, which is to extract data, to steer behavior, to maximize profits.
Mm.
And that is inherently dysfunctional and disturbing.
Yeah, it's very scary to think about, especially when you talk about, like, you know, the study had influenced how you turned out. How is being on social media as a teenager going to influence the outcomes of a kid? We don't even fully understand that yet.
Right. And we don't know how it's going to turn out for these kids who are being sort of shaped by these algorithms online. But I'm super interested to, like, read their memoirs in 10 years. Yeah. I think they're going to be fascinating. Yeah. And I think they're going to be angry.
Oh my God, you're so right. I haven't thought about that yet. The memoirs that come out in the next 10 to 15 years about the children of mommy bloggers and others who grew up online, yeah, are going to be fascinating.
I think in those situations, as of the case with me, is that you kind of surrender your life story to somebody else. And I think it did affect me in that I was unsure if I was the author of the story of my life or if someone else was.
To get a bit of clarity on the answer to that question, one of the things Susanna hoped to track down was the data the Block study collected specifically on her. Like, what do they note about her behavior as a kid? Did they have a sense of how her life would turn out?
I had this idea in my head that they must have collected all this data and it was all going to be in some filing cabinet, like, under the UC Berkeley campus. And if I could just find this file, you know, with my name on the tab and open it, I would sort of understand who I was, how I had become who I was, and maybe sort of who I was meant to be from that point forward.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, that's not what happened. I ended up getting an academic fellowship at UC Berkeley at their investigative reporting program. And I returned to Berkeley, you know, as a very grown-up person to sort of immerse myself in the past, in the very place where this study had begun, and was, you know, sort of intent to find documents that would show to me who the blocks thought I was going to become. The reality was that ultimately, as I understand it, they went through most of the raw data and destroyed it. Some of our data went to a research archive at Harvard, but ultimately, I didn't sort of find the story of my life in a file as I had imagined I would.
Was that like a gut punch initially to realize all that data that you'd been hunting was gone?
I was disappointed. I mean, it was more horrifying. You know, I've been a journalist for a long time, but I've found myself in the spring of 2019 sitting in a room at UC Berkeley with the woman who had been instructed to go through these filing cabinets, pull out most of our data and stuff it into these garbage cans so they could be taken away and destroyed. And hearing that from the mouth of the person who had sort of taken the stuff of my life and shoved it in a garbage can was a little, it was so diametrically opposed to the way that I had framed my story, right? I'm important. I have this important story. I'm part of this important study. And then ultimately you find, your data ends up in a garbage can to be shredded.
Yeah, that's awful. So she didn't find her data. But what do the researchers find after 30 years of data collection? What was the conclusion of the study?
So a longitudinal study like the blocks undertook, which was 3 decades, longitudinal studies are rarely undertaken. They're extremely expensive and they are prone to failure because they are so complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems with a longitudinal study is that once many years down the line, you reach your destination, the world may have already arrived there. So today, we all take it as a given that personality traits are sort of fundamental components of who we are. You know, we use them in hiring. You can take an online personality test.
Yeah.
They're kind of gospel. So ultimately, the study did show, you know, we have these personality traits that remain relatively stable from childhood into adulthood. But by the time they had proved that, sort of, you know, the world was already there. And there's, you know, the big five is now what everyone uses to understand personality. And so while they're, you know, they did make other contributions in a way, the study ended with a bit of a whimper.
Susanna has tried to approach this lack of a tidy ending, both in terms of her own personal data and the search for that, and the study more broadly, with a kind of Zen energy. She sees a silver lining to the fact that she couldn't get her hands on her data.
Now, if I had, that would not have necessarily given me the answer that I imagined either, because it would have still been somebody else is always the expert in me. Because that's how I had grown up. And so sort of not being able to find the file I imagined I would find forced me to sort of construct my own narrative and decide for myself who I was rather than entrusting that task to somebody else.
And so, yeah, you said that prompted you to make your own narrative about yourself. What is the story you tell about yourself now to yourself?
I have no idea. You know, I don't really believe evidences. I have some skepticism when it comes to research because I sort of know how the sausage gets made now.
Right.
You know, we all live our lives by this published research we hear about. Oh, I gotta follow the Mediterranean diet, or I gotta fast X number of days because this study said so, or this study said so. Or I'm like, okay, well, how did the investigator handle the data? And is this really what we should conclude from what they found? So I sort of frankly reject the premise of the study itself. In my opinion, my principal investigators believed that a person was the sum total of their data, that a human being was sort of the answer to a mathematical equation. And if you could just make the right calculation or perform the right analysis or extract the correct amount of data, you could understand that person. Mm. And I think that is wrong. And I think that there is something about people that goes beyond that, that there is a certain sort of essential nature to people that is impossible to quantify. And so I think it was helpful for me to let go of my own sort of science worship. Mm. I don't want to say that sound like an anti-vaxxer because I'm not.
Right. I think I know what you're getting at there.
You know, there's no end point. I always bump up against this sort of at the end of, or towards the end of an interview where I feel like I'm supposed to deliver a happy ending.
Mm.
That's just not my experience, but I'm still, as in a way, I'm still sort of in it, and I'm still at sort of dutiful subject trying to tell its story and continue its legacy.
Yeah.
And I think that brings me some type of comfort where I feel like this thing was of value to me and I was of value to it. And as long as that still continues, then there is meaning and a higher purpose to my life. And that's what continues to push me forward.
That is Susanna Breslin, journalist and author of Data Baby, My Life in a Psychological Experiment. Now, we spoke briefly in this episode about social media and how being watched by tech companies might be affecting young people. Next week, we're going to go deeper into a related topic, which is the psychological implications of artificial intelligence. And one of the things we're going to talk about is deepfakes and the impact that deepfake pornography and disinformation can have on how we think about ourselves and others.
Right. I know if I opened my computer and I saw 100 videos of me doing and saying things, and it looked and sounded just like me, but I'd never said that or never did that.
Right.
If I start watching those all day, within a day or two, I'm going to start questioning, do I think those things? Mm. It's going to, in the same way, if I watch it about a politician, it changes my opinion of them. It's going to change my opinion of myself. So you're going to see radical challenges to self-concept, to personality, to the idea of identity, to an individual. And this is, you know, this is going to, again, like with social media and Facebook, the sharp pointy end of this is going to hit teenagers.
Yeah.
And while their brain is still developing, and it's going to do pretty nasty things to their mental health. Anxiety is going to go up. There's going to be confusion, uncertainty. There's going to be more questioning of their self, who they are. And I don't think any of those things are going to be good.
Pretty scary to think about. That is next week with Professor Joel Pearson from UNSW. But in the meantime, that is it for All in the Mind this week. Thanks to producer Rose Kerr and sound engineers Dylan Prinz and Russell Stapleton. This episode was written, edited, and presented by me, Sana Kadar. And thank you for listening. I will catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.